1989, poetry reading with Allen Ginsberg, Bobby Louise Hawkins, Stephen Taylor, Ann Waldman, and Dancer.
Me? I'll play some songs by myself and by my collaborators.
Calls the tune, whose bread I eat, his song I sing. Payola is not an unmixed boon, pig nose led by a golden ring. Tell me how a man gets his poem, funny, unsunny Mark Twain spoke, and I'll tell you how the cake gets broke, and I'll show you where the axe gets home. America, land of the free, America, home of the knave, jeweled casket of the Indian brave, golden tomb of black liberty. Americans landless in their home, Americans homeless on their land, stalking unto others whom they screw before they market it to you. I hear your song sung round the world, it's very loud but it's not clear. Well, the rag of justice is unfurled. I hope that's not our death dirge that we hear. I hear your song sung round the world. It's very loud and now it's clear. Well, the rag of vengeance is unfurled. Is that your shroud upon your bier? Who plays, who calls a tune must pay the piper. Singing while you eat, well, you could choke. Sinuous but deadly bends the viper, and the American century's a joke. Well, who calls a tune must pay the piper. Singing while you eat, well, you could choke. Sinuous but deadly bends the viper, and the American century ends a joke.
Thank you. There's Elliot. This is a new song. It hasn't been recorded. It was premiered last night on the radio at Muddy's Java Cafe in Denver. It's a False Prophet song. It's called Invisible People, and it's about Tompkins Square Park in New York City.
Call your own, but the building always owned by somebody. You could never call it home.
Albums. It's the melody is taken from ancient Jewish temple music, and the words are taken from Matthew Arnold. Dover Beach. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out on the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray, where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles, which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Thanks. Alan? I'm going to try something new. This has never been performed before. Alan was kind enough to read a poem at the beginning of the song for me in the studio last year, and we're going to try to do it now.
Song. The weight of the world is love. Under the burden of solitude, under the burden of dissatisfaction, the weight we carry is love. Who can deny? In dreams it touches the body, in thought constructs a miracle. In imagination, anguishes till born inhuman, looks out of the heart, burning with purity, for the burden of life is love, but we carry the weight wearily, and so must rest in the arms of love at last, must rest in the arms of love. No rest without love. No sleep without dreams of love. Be mad or chill, obsessed with angels or machines, the final wish is love. Cannot be bitter, cannot deny, cannot withhold if denied. The weight is too heavy, must give for no return. As thought is given in solitude, in all the excellence of its excess. The warm bodies shine together in the darkness. The hand moves to the center of the flesh. The skin trembles in happiness and the soul comes joyful to the eye. Yes, yes, that's what I wanted. I always wanted. I always wanted.
Getting longer, dear M. Vines are overgrown, dear M. Autumn mist among the huts, dear M. I don't mind being alone. Dear M. Maple leaves are turning, dear M. Trains running slow, dear M. Please don't worry about me. I can let go. I can let go, dear M. Dear M. Days I walk along the river, dear M. I don't know what to do, dear M. Time passes slowly, but I could wait for you. I could wait for you, dear M. Thought it over slowly, dear M. Understand more than you know, dear M. Still a part of me is screaming, don't go.
Thank you. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in Cave 63, one of the archaeologists got up to answer the call of nature and wandered into Cave 64 and came across a scroll hitherto unknown, which was translated with much difficulty, and it turns out to be the first national anthem ever written. So we're going to sing it for you tonight. Seems appropriate in the new sort of new wave of patriotic brouhaha that we we give you the first example of the national anthem.
Let them all go to hell except Cave 64. If they gives you any trouble, throw them out the door. This is our cave, it's the best in the world. And we don't want no foreigners here, our cave might get spoiled. We don't want no walks here, our cave could get spoiled. Our cave is the best, to hell with the rest. We got the prettiest girls, they never fail the test. We got the greatest music, we got the bestest brains. 'Cause we always eat the cortex of the ones that we have slain. Yeah, we love to slurp gray matter from the ones that we have slain. Ruling comes natural to those that excel. The rest of you bastards, you can go to hell. God gave us power and God made us right. And if you don't like it, we'll stab you in a fight. Yeah, if you don't like it, we'll kill you in the night. Let them all go to hell except Cave 64. If they give you any trouble, throw them through the door. This is our cave, it's the best in the world. And we don't want no walks here, our cave could be spoiled. No, we don't allow no foreigners here, our cave might get spoiled.
Thank you. Homeless, there's another group of people that's kind of been neglected. This is a song about that.
Park bench bums, veins without a steeple, useless sore thumbs. Leftover people, work all done. Futures in the past, now the past done come. Leftover people, haven't got a dime. Memories are crippled, but we're prisoners of time. Once we were merry, nubile and young. Sailors for the future, happy heart and singing tongue. The revolution left us, the left passed us by. No loving in the present, no pie in the sky. Without drums, leftover people, vanities come. Lake without a ripple, string without a strum.
Thanks. guy that wrote this song, I think he's the only guy that ever recorded it, and he's gone now, so somebody's got to sing it, because it's really a great song, so I'm going to try.
Tiptoes to my room every night, just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, go to sleep, everything is alright. I close my eyes and I slip away into the magic night. Softly say a silent prayer like dreamers do, then I fall asleep to dream my dreams of you. In dreams I walk with you. In dreams I talk to you. In dreams you're mine. All of the time we're together. In dreams. But just before the dawn, I wake and find you're gone. I can't help it, I can't help it if I cry.
Thanks a lot. Good night. Elliot.
Let's have a look. Yeah, I would. Thank you.
How's that? Okay. I want to start with Mrs. Florence Foster Jenkins. Is Harry Smith here? I'm going to dedicate this to Harry Smith. He told me, I saw him about 5 minutes after he arrived, and he told me he had managed to come by a tape of Mrs. Florence Foster Jenkins. And when I was in California touring with Rosalie and Terry, Terry told me that she had managed to come by a tape of Florence Foster Jenkins. And I think I'll just find an old record and pirate them if I'm going to start a whole revival of Florence Foster Jenkins. I'm sure most of you have never even heard of her. You've heard of her. Of course you have. You have not. You've heard her. You heard her in performance? Oh, Larry, you lucky guy. Mrs. Florence Foster Jenkins, the noted, if controversial, coloratura soprano, gave the most celebrated concert of her career on October 25th, 1944 at Carnegie Hall. The performance was sold out, including standing room. Scalpers were peddling tickets at $20. More than 2,000 people were turned away, and police were in attendance to keep out gate crashers. All to hear a concert by a 76-year-old woman who could not carry a tune and had no sense of rhythm. She was one of the great jokes of the time. Some of her performances were simply an audience laughing from beginning to end. She was undaunted, never thought of herself in any but the most serious fashion, believed the laughers were a claque, paid to disrupt her concerts by other singers who were jealous of her success. One lot of reviewers loved to carry on the joke, wrote things like, "Mrs. Florence Foster Jenkins gave her usual riveting performance," "In better voice than ever." Her attitude was at all times that of a singer who performed her task to the best of her ability. Other reviewers were more truthful. Her singing was hopelessly lacking in semblance of pitch. And she was undaunted by the composer's intent. She was notorious for high notes that continued to rise beyond her ability to make them heard. The listeners would watch while Mrs. Jenkins continued to sing without any sound whatsoever. After a while, the music would return to lower registers and she would return from the void. She was dubbed the First Lady of the Sliding Scale. Her career began when she was 41 years old, and her father, who had refused to let her go to Europe when she was 17 and study music professionally, died. She had never let her early dream die, and with the money she inherited, she began to stage her own concerts, hiring halls and paying all the costs, with the proceeds usually going to charities, often to needy young artists. She had many admirers, among them Enrico Caruso, who felt that her spirit was unique. When she was asked how she felt about her bad reviews, she said, "Some may say I couldn't sing, but no one can say I didn't sing." For many years, the most space-consuming building in the town was an overpriced Italian food fish grotto restaurant named Tarantino's. This is, any of you who know Bellinas, remember this place. I mean, if you knew it then. It was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Tarantino in their late 60s, early 70s, who came from Sicily and spent their lives putting every egg into this one basket that would be their cornucopia and return them to Sicily to live like millionaires in their old age. Before building codes, that building bent and twisted itself into every available bit of space, up, down, and sideways. It was added onto, taken away from, reconsidered, ending up finally in a rambling warren of unmatched rooms painted pink. All that transformation used up the Tarantinos' time, and their old age snuck in through the back door without altering their plans. They continued to dream of Sicily and retirement, while Mr. Tarantino continued his daybreak to midnight schedule, buying supplies, overseeing the kitchen, and acting as resident entertainment, holding forth loudly on anything that caught his attention. Mrs. Tarantino had suffered some misfortune that kept her in a wheelchair. While her husband managed the kitchen and the buying, she, dressed in a replica of the waitress's uniform, kept her eye on the staff. She was a permanent, sour-faced fixture in the dining rooms, her eyes small and mean, watching the waitresses with a hateful expression on her face. She didn't believe even her watchfulness could keep them honest. She was filled with acid knowledge of friendship, waitresses who didn't note down garlic bread, who brought extra sauce from the kitchen, and she watched to see that the waitresses didn't pocket their tips. The agreement was that the waitresses got paid $3 flat an hour. Any tips they got were carried over and put into a small cloth bag next to wherever Mrs. Tarantino sat. Most people liked Mr. Tarantino, nobody liked Mrs. Tarantino, and Mrs. Tarantino liked nobody. She sat and glared, too late for Sicily, too late for anything but to be an old woman in a wheelchair in a green waitress uniform with a beige collar and cuffs in a pink restaurant, every room on a different floor level, surrounded by customers who would cheat if they could, an old woman in the wrong country, in the ruin of all of it. She did finally die, and Mr. Tarantino was left to plan for Sicily alone. Every morning at 6, he was in the restaurant's small front room at the lunch counter to give coffee and breakfast to people on their way to work. One morning at 6:05, I was there as well for sustenance. I wanted coffee. Maybe I'd even have breakfast. What are you doing here this early? I've been fighting all night with my husband. I decided to leave for a while. You marry? He shrugged his shoulders. You fight. Me and my wife, we had a fight every day for 53 years. So what else? Did you expect something else? He watched me, waiting to hear just what kind of fool I might be. Yeah, I guess I wanted something else. Wanted? You wanted? Sure, we all wanted it different. Everybody wants it different and thinks wanting it different will make it different, but nobody gets it different. That's marriage. You get married, you fight. That's what it is. Everybody gets it that way. You know, anybody got what they wanted? Yeah, I see people that look like they're happy together. I see people that don't fight all the time. They're liars. They keep it hid. They do it where nobody can see them do it. When they're with people, they smile, but it isn't any different with them. Oh, come on. It isn't always rotten. There must be some people who should be married to each other and who are happy. Nobody. Nobody has it different. That doesn't mean they shouldn't get married. That doesn't have anything to do with it. You figure we weren't put on this world to be happy, hmm? I don't know why we're on the world or if there's a why, but I know nobody's happy. You think not being married would make you happy? No, I don't think that. I do think not being married would have let me sleep last night. I wouldn't have had to fight just because somebody wanted to fight. You'd find something else. You don't have to marry trouble to have trouble. There's plenty kinds of trouble. Somehow this cup of coffee wasn't giving me the solace I'd hoped for. I didn't come down here to get in an argument with you. If I want to argue, I can go home. You call this an argument? This is talking about something. If we were having an argument, you'd know it. If I was arguing with you, you wouldn't be able to stand it. I've been a fighter from when I was born. I came out of my mother kicking and yelling, and I haven't changed since. Well, you're right. I'm not that good at it. Let's talk about something else. Mr. Tarantino filled my cup and changed the subject by about 1/2 inch. You know my wife? I never met her. I saw her in the restaurant. In a wheelchair? Yeah, she was in a wheelchair. That was her. We came from the same village in Sicily. She had a temper. She'd fly off the handle over nothing, over nothing. And me, I had a temper. We both were hotheads. When we got engaged, people in our village started making bets on us. They said we wouldn't stay together a month. Plenty money on it. Everybody from miles came to see us married. They were all interested, like watching the start of a horse race. They all smiled and wished us happiness and all that, and looking at them, you couldn't tell which way they had betted. Me and her, we got to the bedroom, and the first thing we did before we took off any clothes or kissed or anything was we made a pact that we would stay together for a month. We weren't going to let anybody make money on us. A month. We both agreed. He gave me some more coffee. By the time you've lived with somebody for a month, you can live with them for the rest of your life. Well, she couldn't do anything for herself. I had to take her to the bathroom. I had to wipe her. I had to bathe her. Finally, I had to take her to the hospital because I couldn't swallow for her. She couldn't swallow. She couldn't go to the bathroom. They put all these tubes in her and out of her. All she could do was lie there. They did whatever they wanted to. That woman suffered. She never stopped suffering from the time she got to the hospital. She begged me to take her away, to bring her home and let her die. They wouldn't let me. They said it would kill her to take her away. It took her a long time to die. That's awful. What an awful way to die. That's the new way to die. That's how everybody's gonna die from now on. Boy, I hope it doesn't happen to me. It's gonna be worse for you. It's gonna be worse for you. They're gonna know more by the time you die. Mr. Tarantino did make his try for Sicily. He sold the restaurant. The deal was in escrow, and he was still in charge of the place when he burned it down. Late one night, March 21st, spring equinox, 2 or 3 in the morning, he turned a full barrel of some kind of oil over onto the floor, let it run and spread, and set it on fire. He didn't think at all about the people asleep in 3 small apartments on the second floor. Someone woke up because of the noise, or the smoke, or the noise Mr. Tarantino was making, banging around. He started the fire, then he changed his mind and tried to put it out. He was rescued, black from smoke, and distraught. He was taken away in an ambulance to the hospital to be treated for smoke inhalation and burns. Then he was taken to Napa to be treated as a mental case. He deserved better, however much he had insisted there couldn't be a happy ending. He did escape from Napa, briefly. It was written up in the newspaper. The town cheered, thinking that even as they were reading the story, he might be in Sicily. That was a vain hope. For starters, there wasn't any money. His burning the restaurant down invalidated the insurance. And besides, there was the reality he must have been facing in that late night darkened kitchen. Retirement had meant in the earlier planning that he and his wife would go to Sicily and live there. He must have acknowledged it, that he was going there to die among strangers, and chose not to. Instead, because he must have seemed crazy enough to, he just had to spend the rest of his life in the nut house. A man with a hot temper, caught and kept. His last memories of his own life being that chaos of fire and desperate fighting against it. Spending the last years in Napa, he used to say, "Only God can keep you warm." In the middle of Bobo, there's a hole where the Pink Restaurant was, a big bite taken by Mr. Tarantino, who saw his future, if the end and death can be called a future, coming toward him that late night, a bite bitten out and left there. It's called Burnt Park. And by taking the few roles that suited her accent. She was the grandmother in the Wolfman movies. She sat on the bench seat of the gypsy caravan with its little lantern hanging in the corner. and drove the horse so Lon Chaney Jr. would be free to look up and see that the moon was full. Whenever he looked up, there it was, full and round, with dark nighttime clouds scudding past, so the moon looked like it was sailing through the sky at a fast clip. It gave a brilliant light and let us see Lon Chaney Jr.'s hands growing hair and starting to shape into claws. We saw his face beginning its transformation, and we saw Madame Uspanskia's face overcome by mingled distress and compassion. When her grandson was on the verge of being more the wolf than the man, he would leap awkwardly into the road and go running into the dark woods. Madame Uspanskia's voice, tender and elegant, would follow him. "Don't go. Stay with me. We will go to the mountains. I will take care of you. You will be cured." He never stayed. It was always too late. The bright white moon, the grandmother's voice, and the sound of the wolfman crashing his way through the brush always happened. I accepted it as I accepted it that when Tarzan grabbed the next vine, it always carried him in his intended continuing direction. But somewhere in my depths, I noticed, and years went by, and all at once, pop, the bubble surfaced. Why were they always surprised by the full moon? Even if calendars hadn't been invented or gypsies didn't use them, they must have noticed it sometime that the moon regularly waxed and waned. So I began to think about the writer who wrote those movies, and I figured out what was going on there. Premenstrual syndrome envy. That writer had a mother or a sister or a girlfriend or a wife or all four who once a month would scream, "What do you mean good morning? You want the car keys? You think because there was a car yesterday, there's a car today?" Typical. The telephone rings, she rips it out of the wall. And he goes to work to write a nice little movie about gypsies, a simple musical romance with violins, with a suitable role for the latest blonde starlet who's sleeping with somebody important. Life is bitter in his mouth. Gypsy violins, an old grandmother, gypsy girls in low-necked blouses, and Lon Chaney Jr. The only role that ever brought out Lon Chaney Jr.'s talent was when he played a mentally defective hired hand in Of Mice and Men. He fondled small animals to death and carried the corpses around in his pockets until his friend and keeper made him throw them away. The pair dreamed of owning a farm where Lon Chaney Jr. could take care of the rabbits. Let's not examine that too closely. The writer has been pounding his head against the wall, trying to think of something he can have Lon Chaney Jr. do in gypsy drag. He can't play the violin. He can't dance gypsy dances. This is what the writer's life has come to. He's stuck between his job, where he's writing romance for a 35-year-old man with a hoop in his ear whose grandmother won't let him drive the wagon, and his home, where he's regularly got a mad woman with monthly perks. And he can't blame her because she doesn't do it. It happens to her, and voila. The full moon crashes in the sky like a gong, and Lon Chaney Jr. grows teeth and claws and kills everything in sight. Madame Uspanskia will never take him to the mountains in time. He will never be cured. He is helpless forever under the transforming moon. Picture a couple sitting on a couch, holding hands, late at night. They are in their home. It is late fall, the dark has come early, the lights are lighted, and in the kitchen, the dishwasher is washing the dinner dishes. Their television is on. They are watching a program on ecology. The couch they're sitting on is foam rubber, possibly carcinogenic. Possibly a factor in sterility in males. The couch cover is a mix of cotton and something that lets it be washed easily. It has been sprayed with chemicals that keep it from absorbing stains. Their feet rest on a carpet of petroleum derivative. The drapes are also a petroleum derivative. Petroleum derivatives are notorious for inducing allergies. His chest is slightly congested. He is trying to stop smoking. She has hay fever and is looking forward to the winter when all that lively stuff that plays hell with her nose is dead, dead, dead. On television, the commentator is listing food additives that should be guarded against. The program is sponsored by a health food store that sells health appliances. A commercial comes on for stationary rowers and stationary bicycles. Muscles that are allowed to deteriorate can make the body feel that it is rotting. An old piece of fruit left in a bowl, beginning to grow phthalo green mold, undesirable, however beautiful. Bodies that are unused haven't even the advantage of wonderfully colored molds. Bodies that are unused become lumpy and misshapen, unattractive. People who feel unattractive limit their sexual activity, feel awkward and exposed and repulsive. Feeling repulsive has the effect of a spreading stain. It extends to one's normal daytime world, makes one shy and nervous, can cause the fingers to twitch, and oneself to feel like a caricature from a Dickens novel, can make one self-involved in a counterproductive way. One's job can suffer. Nervous twitchers don't get promotions. The dishwasher runs the wash water out and begins to rinse. The powdered soap that is most effective in dishwashers is filled with harsh cleansers. It could never be used in a normal dishpan with human hands doing the work. That is the advantage of the machine. The hands need not be made raw and sore by being in contact with the soap. If the dishwasher is good enough to rinse the dishes thoroughly, it will also be the case that the stomach will not be harmed. As a public service, the television is listing ways to make the kitchen safer. The kitchen is the room in the house where accidents most often happen. In the kitchen, the sharp knives gleam in their holder near the stove. The explosive gas stove waits for a light. Hot scalding water is poised in the tap. There are electric plugs nearby for all the small appliances. Because it is a cool night, the windows are closed. The gas central heating is on. Indoor pollution proliferated when householders responded to the fuel shortage and the rise in heating costs by insulating, by weather stripping doors and windows, making their homes airtight. Now, the indoor pollution is often higher in well-to-do houses than it once was inside factories producing asbestos. The couple we are watching is a two-salary family. They have an eclectic assortment of furniture, Danish modern, Sears Baroque, and almost antique. It is variously stuffed, covered, and finished. All the odors of new cloth and varnish are being held in their well-insulated living room and breathed in and out over and over as the couple sit. The health food store advertises an air purifier. The couple own their environment. They own the floors under their feet, the walls with doors and windows that hold the ceiling and roof over their heads. Their house has small patches here and there of termites, powder beetles, and dry rot. When they can afford it, the entire house will be covered by a plastic bag and be so intensively poisoned that all the pests will be killed. Some of their more ecology-minded friends have warned them that the gas does leave a residue. They can expect to be living in a poisoned atmosphere for a while. The dishwasher turns itself off with a soft whine. None of these perils loom paramount in the couple's mind. When the health food store advertises herbs and vitamins to combat the destructiveness of stress, they don't pay much attention. They're happy. They're happy to have found each other, to be in their new house with their new furniture. They're young and modern. They met in a singles bar and were delighted to learn that they both are market researchers. It's great to have something in common. They yawn as the television set announces its next disaster. They smile at each other, stand, take turns in the bathroom, the second most dangerous room in the house, and go upstairs. They will go to bed among allergenic bedding and make love with all the sexual partners either one has ever had, hovering like dark angels, and they will go to sleep. It is hoped they will dream. Research shows that people who don't dream are headed for trouble. And I think instead of finishing with something of mine, because this is a literary event, I'll finish with something of someone else. A review of Lady Chatterley's Lover that appeared in Field and Stream magazine. Although written many years ago, Lady Chatterley's Lover has just been reissued by the Grove Press, and this pictorial account of the day-by-day life of an English gamekeeper is full of considerable interest to outdoor-minded readers, as it contains many passages on pheasant raising, the apprehending of poachers, ways to control vermin, and other chores and duties of the professional gamekeeper. Unfortunately, one is obliged to wade through many pages of extraneous material in order to discover and savor those sidelights on the management of a Midland shooting estate. And in this reviewer's opinion, the book cannot take the place of J.R. Miller's Practical Gamekeeping. Thank you.
End with Father Death Blues, which Stephen and I have sung often. Hey, Father Death, I'm flying home. I know where I'm going. Father Death, don't cry anymore. Mama's there underneath the floor. Brother Death, please. please mind the store. Old Auntie Death, don't hide your bones. Old Uncle Death, I hear your groans. Old Sister Death, how sweet your moans. Old Children Deaths, go breathe your breaths. Sobbing breasts will ease your deaths. Pain is gone, tears take the rest. Genius Death, your art is done. Lover Death, your body's gone. Father Death, I'm coming home. Guru Death, your words are true. Teacher Death, I do thank you for inspiring me to sing this blues. Buddha Death, I wake with you. Dharma Death, your mind is new. Sangha Death, we'll work it through. Suffering is what was born. Ignorance made me forlorn. Tearful truths I cannot scorn. Father Breath, once more farewell. Birth you gave was no thing ill. My heart is still, as time will tell. Still, as time will tell.